Good evening, sir. Are you good?
I'm very happy to be here, Mr. D.
I know you had a close encounter of the third kind on the way here tonight.
I'm stopped at a red light.
Yeah.
The green arrow goes, and I think it's my turn, and I see cars coming towards me but turning across my bows as they do their right turn, and I think there's an extra lane moving here, am I correct? And one car goes straight across my bows.
Yes.
And I look up and check the green arrow. I'm correct. He ain't. He's just driven off through the red light. And that was the latest in this day. Tony, they've gone ratty. Really, people are concerned about parking and shopping. Their minds are on other things. Everybody's a bit frantic. If I'd condensed everything I've seen today, truly...
I have to say, I was travelling about a kilometre and a half today to go and see my sister, and it was the longest kilometre and a half you've ever experienced.
Well, exactly. I mean, I had a 25K city-type journey to do, and I hopped on the scooter, and I was very pleased I did, because the traffic was just fierce, you know. And as I say, you see people scorching through the traffic, genuinely. And I did a country trip to the capital the other day, and people just seem more frantic, and there are more police around, of course, so... It's a time to be wary, let's put it that way.
Driver beware.
Absolutely. Because people are doing longer distances, they're more distracted, they're perhaps not used to driving as much as the regular weekly commuters, all of this stuff.
I'm terribly sorry, Will, but a red light is a red light. That's the way it plays.
Well, this is true.
Always.
This is true.
If you need to SMS tonight, you can. 0467 922 702. 0467 922 702 will allow you to SMS. We should just at the beginning note some anniversaries.
Yes, because, absolutely.
It's 119 years ago today.
Yeah.
Will's first motor show.
Yes, this was 1894. Now, there isn't total agreement here in the references, but...
Was it good fun?
Holden wasn't yet building bodies. They were doing saddles at that stage. Because the Holden Company, which we'll come to, of course, was started by Holden in 1856.
Yep.
And by 1917 was putting a lot of bodies on... GM cars. But yeah, this for world's first motor show, 1894 in Paris, allegedly 11 exhibitors. But another reference says there are only about 20 cars in France at the time. Certainly 1898 that they got a motor show underway in Paris. The Mondial de l'Automobile, started by an industry pioneer, Albert de Dion. Well, of course, he created the De Dion motor car, but he also created the De Dion rear suspension, which right through until 1880s, at least 1890s, was a unique design of rear suspension and seen as very sophisticated, and it was first used on his cars pre-1900.
It was only 9 years after that that there was a meeting that led to the founding of the Australian... Automobile Club of Victoria.
Indeed, yes, this was nice. They had it at the Port Phillip Club. One of the world's great inventors, Henry Sutton, he was born in Ballarat in 1856, lived to 1912. He'd already designed and built two cars with his own carburetors. He moved the resolution that founded the Automobile Club of Victoria. This was the 9th of December. He did that in 1903.
And a world first, we should highlight, this time 90 years ago, 1923, Maitland, New South Wales, the very first world speedway meeting.
Yes, and this is important.
Under electric lights?
Under electric lights, which by 1923, not everybody had them. But yes, this was important. A guy called Johnny Hoskins, and blow me down, I've in recent times turned up a book by Johnny Hoskins. Talking, it's quite a thin, small book, but talking about that meeting and then going to the Speedway Royale in Sydney, then going to England and the various riders of the time and how it all went and so on. And yes, as you say, 90 years ago in Maitland in New South Wales, in the Hunter Valley area, and that's when Speedway started. And the first World Championships, that was 23, 13 years later, 1936, they had the first World Championship, and it was won by an Australian, Lionel Van Praagh. And 2 years later, it was won by another Aussie, Arthur Bluey Wilkinson from Bathurst. We've got a grand history in Speedway.
We should also remark that it's about to be the 35th running of the Dakar Rally. These days it's in... I think it starts in Argentina.
Yes, it does. Yeah. It does. And it's going into Bolivia for the first time. Countries, this event is so big and provides such good publicity for the countries. It's so well filmed. It's run by the same...
It used to be the Paris-Dakar.
Yes. And then they had a problem in 2008 where 24 hours before the start of the event, imagine, Tony, factories... doing all their testing, the shipping, the building of the cars and everything. Tens of millions of dollars, many tens of millions of dollars.
Yep.
All gathered, something around 500 bikes, cars, trucks, quads, all ready to go. And 24 hours before the start of the event, they say, it's not on, it's not postponed, it's cancelled. And that year, no Paris-Dakar, no Dakar event. Move it to South America, been an enormous success ever since. Atacama Desert, the driest desert in the world. And over the Andes Mountains, and 8,500 kilometres. I implore everybody, as I say, it's the same company that runs the Tour de France, and we all know how beautiful the filming is of that event, and what a wonderful travelogue it is of where that event goes. And
some Aussies competing this year?
Yes, there are six on bikes and three in four-wheel drives, cars as they call them. Mm-hmm. So it's down on numbers, the event's down on numbers, about 375 entries, but 8,500 kilometres. It's on free-to-air in the evening, so it sort of runs the better part of a day late. Mm-hmm. But pay TV has it at 9 in the morning. Less than half a day later, a half-hour program, and it's absolutely wonderful. It's one of the toughest events, greatest adventures you could ever imagine. I've talked to drivers who've done it and riders, and they say, oh, it takes me about 3 weeks to recover. Stefan Peter Hansel has won it six times on a motorbike, five times in a car. He's going for his 12th win. Quite a remarkable guy. Hubert Auriol was the first guy to win it on a bike and then follow that up with a win in a car. But an event of great history and toughness.
Let's talk about Holden. Obviously, it's been very warm news. In fact, I think last time you were on, we had reports coming through.
Yes, that's right, we did.
Holden was going to pull the plug. It was revealed a short time after that. 2017, no more locally developed Holdens, just as the Holden-built Chevrolet SS has just gone sale in the United States.
And they've raved about it. It's based on VF Commodore. They have, and rightly so, too. A number of things, Tony, to consider seriously about this. Some inside information, which I can't verify, but it comes from a Holden guy who's now with another company,
yep,
in a fairly senior position. And he said they were really battling and trying to hold on. And that was an enormous problem, as we've all acknowledged. But they were trying to do that. And Mike Devereaux was hopeful. And they were in discussion. And then there were some robust statements in federal parliament. And it's alleged from this source that the Yanks said, oh, well, we don't like this. They can go to blazes, you know. Mm. And quickly made the decision. And that's the way, of course, Devereaux reported it, because he was in front of a parliamentary committee and then said, we're hopeful, we want to keep manufacturing, was his statement. And then 24 hours later, he said, we're off. So it could be that America suddenly just made the decision. Who'll ever know? But a lot of things come out of this.
What's going to be left?
Well, they will sell their Lang Lang Proving Ground, which both of these companies, Ford and Holden, are going to make an enormous amount out of the real estate that they get rid of. Mm. Ford's going to keep the Yu Yang's Proving Ground and keep its design and engineering development. So they're actually losing fewer workers, factory assembly people, than they will retain in design and engineering. but nevertheless, they'll obviously shrink their operation. The Yuyang Ford Proving Ground is one of a small number that Ford has in the world, so it's regarded as a very valuable facility. And they've done some very successful projects in recent times for China and for India, and of course for the world, in the sense of the Mazda BT50 Ute and the Ford Ranger Ute. Incidentally, running in the Dakar, prepared by Ford South Africa, a V8 engine in these Ford Ranger Utes, which uses so much fuel under Dakar off-road competition conditions that it will carry 500 litres of fuel in its tanks. Weighs nearly 2 tons, but it's a serious entry, and it's backed by Ford. Mm. And that's a vehicle designed primarily in Australia, albeit that it's made in Thailand and it's made in South America. And these particular utes, the other location that they make them in the world is in South Africa, and that's where this entry is coming from. Tony, a number of things will come out of this, like Mitsubishi, like Nissan. They'll go to being a full importer. The most notable thing is this, and this is factual. It's not, you know, influenced by emotion or anything else. We will get price rises, and we will get cars that, for local conditions, aren't as good as Commodore and Falcon. Now, let me substantiate that. Going back quite a few years, let's go back 10 years, Commodore Falcon was selling in big volume, and they were making some reasonable money, and so they were competitively priced. But they had such a part of the market in terms of what they offered in size and in performance and in features and so on at the price that they affected an enormous amount of the pricing in the market. If you wanted to sell a Mazda of half that size, you couldn't charge the same as Ford or Holden were charging for a full-size family car. Sure. If you were selling a Benz that might not have any more equipment than that and was much smaller and had a smaller four-cylinder engine or something, you couldn't charge three times the price. You might charge one and a half or twice the price of it and so on. So it had an enormous influence on the market overall. Now, come forward to now, and their volumes have been falling, obviously. And take the case particularly of Holden. VE not working nearly as well as they wanted it to do. Go to VF, spend a lot of money, probably $500 million, develop VF, make it a much better car, more appealing, move it up a little bit in terms of how people see it, in terms of its, you know, luxury equipment and presentation and so on. And Tony, significantly reduce the prices because they needed more volume, which they're getting. So they reduced prices on a much better equipped car. I've just given back a BMW that costs more than double what the Holden costs, and it didn't have a fraction of the equipment that's on Commodore, on base Commodore for $35,000. So does Holden like selling those cars for that price? No, sir. So look at Ford. Ford's got the Falcon. They've got the Mondeo. A Mondeo costs more than a Falcon. It's a smaller car. When Toyota got rid of Cressida, that was roughly a 40 grand car, they went to an equivalent Lexus for 60 grand. It was 50% more expensive, and it was about 7% better. That's what Holden and Ford will be doing. They'll be offering a car or cars that are a little bit better, and they'll be significantly more expensive. They want to get out of this locked-down price that they've been forced into to try to move these cars that allegedly Australians don't want to buy. I mean, they're still buying a significant number of them, particularly of Commodore, more than 3,000 a month. So that's the first thing that'll come out of it.
I have to ask, I mean, do you think the Holden mark will disappear?
Some suggested it. GM's a funny situation. It's the only car company, or Fuji Heavy Industries is Subaru, and once upon a time Nissan was making Datsuns, but basically GM is the company and doesn't make a GM car. It makes a Chevrolet or a Holden or an Opel or whatever. They've tried to get rid of Opel and Vauxhall in Germany or Europe and Vauxhall in England, and it didn't work. If they tried it, Tony, it would be disastrous. people just would not cop it. This company has got a history of more than 150 years in Australia. It made the saddles for the Australian troops in the Boer War. It was started in Adelaide, as I said before, in 1856.
Yep.
It was the first company to produce a car in volume in Australia, albeit, and this is an interesting one too, in terms of the queries we've had from government or to government about we need some finance. When Lawrence Hartnett, who was setting up Holden originally and getting this project underway pre-1948, went to GM in America, they said, fine idea, go for your lives, boys. We're putting in no money, you finance it. And so they went to the Commonwealth Bank and got a loan. And of course they got, it wasn't an Australian designed car, it was a design that had been done in America, been put on the shelf, had never gone into production. It was to be a small American car, and it was modified and so on and developed and became the 48215, later the FJ, and on it went. So to get rid of that name, Tony, would be crazy, but it has been suggested, and I've no doubt that back in Detroit, they've certainly around the boardroom said, what have we got this brand for that only sells in Australia? It's a small market, you know, it's only a million cars a year. But I think the answer will be keep it.
You have a look at GM's recent record here. They've had, of course, Saab in the market. They've had Hummer, Cadillac, Opel, all of them which have not worked.
Well, they sent out the invitations to the release of Cadillac, and they cancelled it before the cars got here. They never actually landed a car or launched the car. I mean, talk about aborted. Hummer came and went, and Opel was just a disgrace in recent times. It was just pathetic. However that happened, whether it emanated primarily from from America and Europe, because Opel is a struggling brand in Europe at the moment, it's losing a lot of money, in trying to expand markets. I've no idea, but it was badly handled here. And there were dealers building independent showrooms, which they told they had to have. Within less than a year, they suddenly discovered that we're not doing the volumes we thought we'd do, that, you know, we're not making money, goodness me. And in that tiny period of a year in a project as big as introducing a new car brand, they abandoned, a bit different to Toyota, among others, saying, Daihatsu, too hard to have a separate brand. Goodbye.
Yeah. Harry says a friend of mine still has a General Motors household oven in their kitchen, which is still working after 40 years.
Gracious me.
It's one of those awkward situations, though. What are they likely to have in their lineup here in Australia?
Well,
is it likely to be Chrysler Australia, basically?
Yeah. Look, GM's got strong tie-ups in Japan and Korea particularly, and we already have quite a few Korean-based models here, and that will continue. Pardon me. They have senior people. Mark Royce, who was a predecessor of Mike Devereaux in Australia, is very senior in General Motors in the United States, and he loves the brand. The funny thing is this. Everybody that they send out to Australia to run Holden loves the brand, loves the country, loves the market, loves the difficulty of it, and becomes very passionate about it and very defensive of the brand and trying to keep it. But look, we'll have no problem with the cars. But again, we've got Holden Malibu here now, which is a similar sized car to Commodore. And a Holden insider said to me, yeah, but it's not nearly as well packaged and hasn't got as much room. And Commodore has a lot of room, yeah. You know.
I have to ask also the speculation around Toyota and Altona.
Yes. Well, and this leads us to part of the nub of the problem, the unions, and it's been a GM thing. It probably, people might find it hard to believe when I say that when General Motors was really flush with money and had a massive market share in America and was making an enormous amount of money. They listened to what workers wanted and went along with them to a large, well, to quite a degree. And ultimately, it was those pension funds and those union agreements that sent General Motors bust a few years ago. Mm. And, you know, it could have fallen over completely if the American government hadn't bailed them out. And the same things happened here to a degree. The severance pay of these workers will be at least $200,000, and some say $300,000 to $500,000. Well, that's fine. When people lose their jobs, they're entitled to, you know, those sorts of agreements exist in all sorts of industries. But there's an enormous amount, significant amount of feather bedding in union agreements. There are union people who do almost no production work in the Holden factories, but what they do is run the union, and they have time off for training and all sorts of things. And the similar situation exists at Toyota. And Toyota, as we know, last week went to the court to ask for, to try to put to the workers and to the unions some variations, quite a few variations, on their Fair Work agreements. Four people in Toyota countered that and went to the court and said they have no right to do this, and stopped the progress of that. Toyota has announced today that they have appealed that decision and still need to go ahead. Now, one of the 20-odd things that Toyota wants to discuss is we want the Christmas shutdown to be brought back to 8 days instead of, I forget, I think it's 25 or 30 or something like that. Do these workers not understand that when you've got that amount of capital cost sitting doing absolutely nothing, that it's a very expensive luxury? And it seems, Tony, I don't say this is for all the workers, but it seems there are some people who'd rather have the argument and stand by their agreements and so on and see the whole thing topple over, as it has with Holden, and it will with Toyota if this goes on. I can tell you, the Japanese think very differently to the Americans, and this sort of court argument and stoppage and so on will not sit comfortably with them in Japan. It really will not. And if that goes on too long, too hard, yeah, Toyota will be squeezed and they will not like it, and I think they will come to a decision that will not please their workers.
Max says, Toyota offered voluntary redundancies recently and were way oversubscribed. Not sure what that says about the local industry.
Well, they've all had, and Toyota's got rid of a lot of people in recent times, yes. In the last cull, they got rid of 1,300. Look, it's tough. But as has been pointed out by a lot of the economists, we don't have an economic advantage in doing this sort of work of making vehicles. And so there are other things perhaps that we should do. Wrestling against it and so on is just, it's just not going to get them there. You've just got to try and run with it and make the best of it.
Will Hagen is with us tonight. We are motor talking, and I'm wondering whether you'd like to join us. You can talk anything four wheels and two. You can talk about road safety, any issues you'd like to raise.
Lines are now open. Call 1300 800 222.
The Nightlife, 105.7 ABC Darwin Territory Radio. Darwin's weather, afternoon shower or storm, 25 to 34 degrees for the Alice. A possible afternoon shower and 25 to 41. And we're taking calls for the challenge. 1300 800 222. 1300 800 222 can win you This Is Christmas, Anthony Collier's brand new CD, plus We Can Be Heroes, Finding the Australian of the Year, Chris Lilley's fantastic comedy. 1300 800 222.
Motor Talk with Will Hagen.
Well, Bob wants a word. Bob, you're saying it's not the unions totally responsible for the demise of the local car industry.
No, that's my opinion, Tony. I think a bigger thing than the unions is the cost of doing business in Australia. It is scary. And people need the money. That's why wages are up. People need the money to be able to live. everything you touch has got government fingerprints all over.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
And business is exactly the same. Everything they do, there's a charge, a tax, a surcharge, a levy or some damn thing on it, and every time you go near the government, you've got to have a licence for something. Now, they need to... The government, and I don't care what colour the government is, in general, the government has got to sit down, reduce the cost of doing business, or we're just not going to have any businesses coming to Australia. There'll be no investment. They've got to cut it, and I'll bet you that if they cut costs of doing business, people won't need so much money, and there won't be such a rush to get a wage rise, and they may even ease back a tiny bit. Yeah, you know, and conditions. That's. I'll leave it at that, Tony. Yeah, no, you and Will talk about it.
Yeah, no, well said, Bob. And I didn't for a minute suggest that it was solely the unions that were the cause of it. That's not the case. It is a very large part of it is the cost of doing business here. It's quite crazy. You could do a very good piece, you know, for 7:30 Report or something, and go round and film the dozen or more warning signs around a Ford or a Holden factory about how things have got to be done and so on. Tony, there's a little visitor information centre near where I have my shop. And they were getting some locals to tear out some long grass and growth and all the rest of it. They had to be inducted as to what to do. Mm. There's a policeman runs a men's shed in another little village, town nearby. They had to be inducted as to how to run a lawnmower. Quite seriously. I'm told, I haven't checked, that Rio Tinto, which is a mining company, that to go into their offices in Brisbane, because they're a mining company, you have to be inducted to go into their office building. I mean, as Bob says, the regulation in this country is unbelievable.
John, you are agreeing that the unions appear to be at fault here. John? Can you hear me? No. Obviously not. John, you want to talk about an ammunition pouch from 1916 with the Holden logo on it.
The Holden and Frost is actually on.
Yes.
1916, the sort of thing the mounted troops wore,
yeah.
Ground troops.
Do you have that?
I have that here at home.
My goodness me. Well, you just make sure you never lose it, sir. Holden, Frost, that...
It's in beautiful condition. It's never been used.
Wow.
The name Frost disappeared after World War One.
Yes, that's right. He joined Holden. I'm trying to think of the original name, but he joined them and the company went from Holden to Holden and Frost.
That's right. Now listed as listed as carriage trimmers.
Right.
But in the First World War, I think they were harness and saddle makers and just about anything.
Yes, that's right. And... that's wonderful to have that, my goodness.
Yes, it sits there, and it's one of my collections.
Oh, well, that's beautiful.
You should write to Holden and tell them that you've got it, because I haven't seen such a thing within the collection of stuff that they have, so you should write and tell them. In fact, if you'd like to give the information to
Michael,
I'll pass on your contact details just for the sake of them knowing where to go if they want to see such a thing.
All right, just putting you back to the switch and we'll do that. Peter, you're saying Holden's going to be irrelevant.
Yes, well, who's going to be stupid enough to buy Holden cars when Singapore Airlines takes over Ansett? And with all this free trade with Asia and the greenies closing down the forestry industry, the timber industry, which naturally related in the collapse of the Caterpillar, and now the close of the shipping line because of the collapse in the forestry. Perhaps if we're still shipping timber, we could be shipping all these cheap cars back here.
You have me confused, sir. The collapse of the timber industry. I adjoin a state forest, and the timber industry above me didn't appear to be collapsed when they're harvesting the trees there recently. Look, Holden will not be irrelevant. This is something that people have to understand.
Yeah.
The backup for cars now, cars in the future, continues absolutely unchanged in terms of warranty, in terms of availability of parts, service, training of dealers, all of that sort of stuff. Their model range will change. It will expand to some degree. But the thing that will happen is that prices will go up. But that's in the longer term. It's not going to happen immediately.
Thanks, Peter. William, you wanted to talk about an incident that you had on the road while you were driving recently.
Yeah, that's correct. I was going to Pinneroo on Monday. Going to Murray Bridge on Monday. I got to Pinneroo at the railway crossing. They're all 80k zones. And I was following this Commodore for several kilometres, and he was doing 95, which is very annoying when you're allowed to do 100. And I got to the railway line, and he actually stopped on the railway line. I'm 100 metres behind him. He stopped.
On the line?
On the line.
Why was he?
I don't know why.
Was he trying to suicide?
Well,
it's crazy, isn't it?
I had right away, and I had lots of horn blowing and flashing of lights, and when he did eventually get going, and I missed him, but he pulled up on a side cut parking bay, and I never saw him again, but very annoying.
Well, frightening.
Frightening for them, I bet it was.
Be frightening for the train driver coming along.
Well, the train driver wasn't involved, but I was in a 42.5-ton truck that can't stop as quick as a car.
Yeah.
And I'm right on.
Yeah.
I nearly put his back window into the front window.
Well, well done in avoiding
him.
Thank
God you're here to tell the tale.
Yes, well done.
An SMS says, car industry is a mobile Ponzi and a generational one. Young people don't drive like baby boomers, and $10 billion bailout to GM while motoring costs skyrocket during a downturn? Question mark.
Motoring costs skyrocket. Cars keep getting cheaper.
Will, you're saying the problem started with the Hawke government.
Yes, mate. Yeah, when Bob Hawke and Paul Keating decided to do their little magic spin doctors and float the dollar and then take away our tariffs and introduce an introduction of free market trade. And then John Howard come along with his no GST under my watch, and hello, here came GST. Julia Gillard comes with no carbon tax under my watch, and here comes carbon tax. And so all the politicians are really not working with us, they're working against us, because they tell us one thing and implement another, and then we have people are entitled to wage, people are entitled to a decent wage for a living. People are entitled to have a social life with their family. People are entitled to have 8 hours rest and then get up and go to work again. That's just basic common sense. And if you take people outside of their social life, well, they're allowed to be penalised, penalty rates for it. And well, it all went out of the, it just kept going up. CPI went up, so everything got dearer. And then the wages went up to meet the CPI, and now it's that dear that, you can't get anything because it's too dear to buy anything.
Well, I must say, a comment from the head of a European car company in Australia only a year or so ago, and she said, in Europe, when politicians go to discuss business, they take business people with them. She said, here it seems to be a conflict between politicians and business. They don't seem to want to work together until finally they're presented with a major problem like this, and then suddenly, they want to be kind and nice to everybody. I mean, it wasn't long ago that people were saying, Commodore doesn't meet emission standards and it doesn't do this and it's too big a vehicle and all the rest of it, and we won't put it in the Green Guide, we won't recommend it, we won't recommend for government departments to buy it and all the rest of it. And then suddenly, when they run into a problem, it's a bit of an about turn and a very costly one for the rest of us who pay taxes. So it is a funny business, whereas I say, often there appears to be conflict between the politicians and the business people, and they should all the way. They shouldn't be munificent. They shouldn't be handing out money to the businesses. What they should be doing is to create an environment where the businesses can get on with doing business economically and well and be successful.
Thanks, mate. Richard, you want to talk about the VW Amarok Ute?
Yes. Well, at the moment I'm driving in Colorado, and it'll be the last Holden I buy. But I'm looking at the Amarok, but I still get a little bit nervous pulling 3-ton plus with a 2-litre engine, even though... But I do believe the 8-speed automatic gearbox is a very good gearbox.
I'm trying to think of what particular vehicle it was where somebody... I just can't recall it, but they went to look at a particular vehicle and they said, I want to tow 2 tons with this. And the salesman very honestly said, I won't sell you the vehicle.
Yeah.
So what I'm saying to you is go into it very deeply with Volkswagen. In terms of the gearbox, this same guy was telling me that he does a lot of travel with a heavy combination of caravan and vehicle, which he's towing with a Toyota. And he follows the Toyota book recommendation that he tows in fourth gear, not in fifth, for the weight that he's pulling.
Yeah, okay.
So for the serious sort of weights that you're talking, that's the sort of thing you need to talk about in terms of warranty, in terms of what they recommend and so on, and doing, if you possibly can, some test driving. What's been your disappointment with Colorado?
Look, the first gearing is too tall. I'm worried about bringing the clutch out. The fuel economy hasn't been there.
So it's a petrol, is it?
No, it's a diesel.
A diesel.
It's the first Duramax, not the second Duramax that they've got on it.
Well, of course, Holden changed, and they they changed the source manufacturer of their vehicle, and they got away from Isuzu and then went to a different source with their Colorado Ute, and their preference probably would have been to be with the original one. I haven't done some much extensive testing of the current Colorado, albeit I looked at one the other day and I thought I'd better grab hold of one. But, yeah, go into it very deeply with Voxie and make sure. But what they have done, too, with the Amarok is they have, in recent times, expanded both the body types available but also the engines.
Andrew from Raymond Terrace says, I recently bought a SSV Redline Commodore. I was undecided between it and the S60 Volvo. Bought the Holden because it was made in Australia. Next time I'll be buying the Volvo.
Why? Not happy with it?
I don't know.
Doesn't say. Well, I'll tell you this, that's been an enormous success, the Redline range. Mm. And I think he'll have actually a fairly good bit of property in the longer term, because I really think when the reality of this dawns, you know, and we get towards 16, 17, and the last of them flow out, people will be quite keen to buy them, actually.
Yeah. Colin, you want a word about the Holden Trax?
Yes. Will, I was wondering if you've done any road testing or anything on the Holden Trax, and how does it stand in the ratings?
Well, there's three little vehicles of that type that have come in. Firstly, there was the Trax, then there was the Nissan Juke, J-U-K-E, and then Ford introduced their EcoBoost little SUV. They've got an EcoBoost Falcon as well, of course, with a 1 litre engine, believe it or not, and also a 1.5 litre engine with an automatic, but the 1 litre with a manual. And look, all I'll say is this, I haven't done any extensive comparative testing of the three vehicles. I've driven them all. They're all a little bit, mostly a bit short of a gear. Their manuals are mostly 5-speed, so if you want to do much country touring, you're probably about a gear short and going to be doing higher revs than is desirable and probably using more fuel than is desirable, so they're more of a round town than long distance touring vehicle. Quite competent, and quite competitively priced. The other thing that's come out in recent times that offers four-wheel drive there is the Suzuki little SX, I think it is, Cross. And it's more sort of hatchback-looking, less SUV-looking, but actually offers both two- and four-wheel drive. So all I'd say is this. Go and have a look at the specs and see what, you know, you agree with and what you want and how they appeal, and do your own comparative testing. But it's in there with those others that have been recently introduced.
Yeah, thanks, Colin. Helen, your husband works for Holden, and you're not blaming the unions.
I'm certainly not blaming the unions. And what concern? I mean, I agree with lots of what you said, and I thought it was really interesting and insightful. But I think when you start banding around amounts like $500,000. You really got to be careful with that. I mean, it's complete nonsense. It really puts people in this ridiculous light, like, oh, you know, they're making so much money and that's the problem, and it's just false. My husband has been working for over 15 years for Holden. He's got a fairly, you know, he's not a manufacturer, he's a engineer designer, or in the engineer design area. And I don't know about these manufacturers that are going to get the workers that are going to get paid $500,000, because, I mean, he's in, I guess, what would be a higher-paid, higher-level role. He's a member of the union, and I can tell you that his wage is significantly under $100,000, and when you work out just your normal retrenchment payout, it will not be anything like that, nothing like it. So it really concerns me. It's very easy to just sort of chuck around information that's completely false and denigrates the unions that have fought very, very hard for these people. And it is a unionised workplace, and my belief is that's why this government didn't stick up for it. The fact that it's a unionised workplace is great. It means it's very structured and very organised and very protective. But the unions are not crazy. They're not out there trying to destroy the industry. Quite the contrary.
Yes, that's some of the economists have argued against that. I'm surprised to hear what you say your husband's wage is in terms of engineering and design, because my understanding is that with shift penalties and various other things that the factory workers can be doing very well, that they're in the area of $60,000 a year and not hard to be getting up into the areas of $80,000 a year. As I said before, I've got no problem with the payouts. Payouts are intended to help people get over this business of being retrenched.
$500,000. Now, you show me, apart from maybe a very, very senior manager, who is getting that.
The commonly accepted numbers that have been talked of in a number of areas in the area of $200,000 or $300,000, as I said, I don't have ma'am, let me finish, please. I don't have an argument with that, and I said that originally, and I said one source has said perhaps as high as more than $300,000. What I'm arguing about, and what I said earlier, was that it costs significantly more to make a car in this country, towards 4,000 more. And part of that is complying with government regulations, and part of that is that the workers do not turn out as much product for their, you know, their given wage as they do in other countries. And if that's a good deal, well, then we can't make cars, and that's the fact of it.
I think you're going from one extreme to another. Sure, we make more than you would in India or a third world country, but these sort of numbers are false. I can tell you exactly what my husband will be paid out, and it will be the equivalent or a bit less than 1 year's salary, because he's worked there for 15 years. It's a very standard formula across all industries when you are retrenched.
Sure, and that's what I say. That's what I say about the payout numbers. I'm not arguing with them.
Yeah, but amounts like $300,000. Well, unless you're in senior management or maybe a financial controller or a very senior person on a really big salary, you will not be getting anything like that. And it's really giving a very false impression of what the workers get and how the whole place is set up. And I think if you're going to talk about numbers, then you have to actually have information and facts, and not just make numbers up that really give unions and the workers, give people an impression that is completely wrong.
Helen, thanks very much for clarifying that. John, you're wondering what's going to happen with HSV.
I certainly am, gentlemen. I'm really worried. Can you help me?
Well, and we haven't mentioned this program, the HSV GTS, which is an outstandingly good motor car, an amazing motor car, for about $105,000, that is competitive in performance and every way dynamically with cars that cost, in fact, it costs 37% as much as a Benz that you would compare it with. I asked that of HSV when I picked this car up about 6 odd weeks ago. I said, what are you going to do when you don't have when and if you don't have a rear-wheel drive, big car, Commodore to play with, and they said, oh, we'll base it on other vehicles. The essence is it remains to be seen. HSV is a separate company run by Ryan Walkinshaw, the son of the late Tom Walkinshaw, who set it up, and Holden Racing Team as well. And so we'll have to wait and see what they decide. It'll be whether they see that it's a viable ongoing business. But I imagine they probably will.
Yeah, thanks for that, John. Harry, Holden Cruz, you're saying originally made in Korea.
Yeah, well, what I was going to say was, like many years ago, and we'll remember when GM Daewoo were here, when Daewoo went broke, GM bought it out, and it was originally called GM Daewoo, and the Australian public didn't accept that. They didn't really buy their product. They disappeared off the scene for 18 months, and they came back with rebadged Daewoos and Holden badges, and that was really the start of the South Korean manufacturing. It was only a matter of time before it was all going to move there.
A little bit simplistic, because the car's been redesigned. In fact, Holden in Melbourne did the hatchback design of that car, and they've done other engineering and design work on it to adapt it to Australian conditions. But the Cruze is a very interesting thing. It was brought into manufacture here to meet the Green Guide requirements because governments and councils were making it difficult to sell Commodores. So it, in a sense, didn't help the situation. They added to their costs to have to get a vehicle locally made that met the locally made definition to be able to sell to councils and governments who are all prissy about, emissions and so on.
All right, Harry, thanks for raising that. Just an SMS that came through also says the payouts are capped at Ford and Holden. That lady's spot on. I'm at Ford and will get $120,000 for 17 years service.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that, and I genuinely. I suspect from the previous discussion with that lady that some of the factory workers might be better off in terms of their net pay with various shift penalties and so on than some of the fixed engineering people, whom Tony, and please verify it for me, I've always admired and always stuck up for them. I reckon they do a wonderful job.
Absolutely. Well, thanks.
Sorry to lose them.
We will speak next year.
Wonderful, sir, if you have me back.
Be brave, Arthur. Yeah, good move.
Thank you.
Will Hagen and Motor Talk tonight.